This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 1957, at the age of 15, Dorothy Counts Scoggins became a pioneer as she walked toward Harding High School in a dress made by her grandmother. Many of her new classmates screamed at her because she was about to become the first black student there. She was about to integrate Charlotte schools. In that same year, Melba Petia Beals had a similar experience as she became one of the 9 African-American students to integrate Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas. They defied mobs, death threats, and physical attacks. For both these women, that experience led them to focus on equality for all and activism in the interest of social justice. In Charlotte, we successfully integrated our schools and became a kind of poster child for how to do that. But today, because of the ending of court-ordered busing to achieve integration, the rebirth of neighborhood schools, the creation of magnet schools, and a burst of choices from charter schools to private education, we have essentially resegregated our schools. How did we make this round-trip journey back in time, and what does it mean for the schools, for children, for society? We're joined this hour by those two pioneers. Dorothy Counts Scoggins joins us in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
And Dr. Melba Petia Beals has joined us by phone from just outside of San Francisco, where it's cold and early in the morning. Doctor, thank
Good
you for
morning.
Being with us. Good morning. And to provide some additional historical perspective, we welcome back Dr. David Goldfield, the Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at UNC Charlotte and author of Black, White, and Southern, and Still Fighting the Civil War. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Dorothy, let me begin with you, because you're the Charlottean here in the room. I said that you were a pioneer in integrating Charlotte's public schools back in 1957. That experience for you, however, only lasted about 4 days because your parents pulled you out and moved you to Philadelphia so you could attend an integrated school there. For those who don't know your story, however, talk about the days leading up to that first day at Harding High. What did your parents, what did people do to prepare you? How old were you then? 15, right?
I was 15 years old, and of course, in terms of preparation for that day, we had a lot of conversations around our dining room table. My father was a minister and, of course, a professor at Johnson C. Smith University, and a part of our family ritual, every day at 5 o'clock, we had to be home at the dining room table, and this is where a lot of conversations took place.
Did anything they say prepare you for what you experienced?
Well, basically, my father said to me, you can do anything that you want to do. You're not inferior to anyone. Hold your head up high. Those were sort of the conversations that we had. I do feel that he protected me by not sharing some of the other kinds of things that were going on, but the telephone calls that they had received. And I asked him about that later, and basically what he said is he did not want me to walk into a sea of fear. Mm. And so we just had general conversations.
So that morning when you did walk into Harding High, was it a sea of fear for you?
Well, I felt some reluctance once I got out of the car and saw the number of people that were there. I had no idea that that many people would be there.
How many people were there?
I would say anywhere from 250 to 300. They were students as well as adults.
More adults than students?
More adults than students.
And what were they, how were they trying to intimidate you?
There was one person who was telling the young ladies to spit on me, which was Miss Warlick, who had formed the White Citizens Council. There were others that were telling, don't let her get inside the door. So most of the things that were being directed by the adults to the students. Hmm.
So you were there for 4 days. Was it like that going to school every day? What was it like inside the school? What was it like in the classroom? How did the teachers react to you? What did students say or do to or with you in those 4 days?
Inside the classroom, basically, it was the same kinds of pushing and shoving as it was on the outside. I was assigned to sit in the back of the classroom. I was not recognized by teachers when I raised my hand. The principal saw things going on in the hall and turned around and walked back into his office.
What does that feel like? You're 15 years old. What does that feel like?
It feel well, first of all, not acceptance, number one. But two, I'm a very determined person. And I just felt that once they got to know who I was, that things were going to change. I had no idea, because I didn't grow up in that kind of world where people treated people that way.
Yeah. Your parents decided after 4 days, that's enough.
And that was after an incident had happened at the school where I had been hit in the back of my head with a sharp object and a blackboard eraser in my back. And as I proceeded to walk out the door at lunchtime, my brother was sitting in the car, and the back window of the car was shattered, and he was sitting in the car.
So, Dr. Beals, you had a similar, if perhaps a more raucous experience in Little Rock, because you not only had the phalanx of students and parents who were upset, you had the Arkansas National Guard that had been called out to block you and other students from coming into the school, and then the addition of the 101st Airborne Division of the Army sent in by President Eisenhower. Were they there to push aside the National Guard? How did all that work?
Well, the rampaging, the difference here was that on the first morning we attended, there was a rampaging mob, hundreds and hundreds of people with guns, ropes, and whatnot to greet us. There were nine of us, and we got separated on that first day. My mother and I got...
Was that deliberately... Were you deliberately separated?
Just for accident. The nine of us were supposed to meet on this one corner because the area is a vast area. Central High School is 8 square blocks in diameter. So the front is 2 blocks long, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
We got separated. A couple people didn't have telephones. But I myself came with my mother, and we were chased the way Elizabeth Eckert was walking directly in front of the troops in front of the school. And we walked up across the street, but behind a layer, 5 or 6 layers of white people. And the thing at first you think is, oh, this sounds like a rodeo or a football game. And you don't really understand that this is a mob. And they're looking across the street at Elizabeth. And so we tiptoed up behind them. And ultimately the guy said, well, we don't have to go across the street to hang us today. We have one right here. So when they spotted us in this crowd, they turned around and they started to chase us and chase us back to our car, telling us that what they were going to do to us before they hanged us. And I write about the fact this was my first contact, direct understanding at 15 that there is a God. You just have to call on God, and he is as close to your skin. Before
well, I want to emphasize that you were threatened with lynching. This is 1957. This is a public place.
That's right. And Karen Rhodes and African-American people at this point were lynched, as somebody said, on Friday night for entertainment. Saturday night, you do too. And
so the 101st...
lynching was a popular thing in that era. Had been, they were trying to quell it, the beginning of trying to quell it, but it had not been done. And so we were shot up. We were lynched. It was a common thing.
So the 101st Airborne
Division.
So the 101st Airborne Division was there to protect you, at least on the outside of the building. Were they on the inside of the building as well? Because
they did not. The 101st was dispatched a couple of weeks, a week after that.
Okay.
First, we had to go to court, et cetera, to get the 101st to come in. And when they did come, however, they guarded us closely, both outside and inside the building. We had at least three primary, secondary, and tertiary bodyguards in full uniform. The ones on the outside were fully armed, carrying bayonets and whatever they needed. The ones on the inside were carrying sharp guns, but they were carrying all the other equipment that they needed.
I understand that once you were in the school, students did all kinds of things to you, made your life miserable. I think I read a story where they put peanut butter laced with broken glass in your seat so that you would sit
right
on it, among other things. And you were tripped a lot. Did either of you suffer any physical harm while you were in?
Oh, to this day, it's difficult. For example, if it rains or something, this one kid walked on my Achilles tendon to and from class, and that sounds alarming, but it's much worse than you think, because what you do is you wound your Achilles tendon, and that's for life. The other thing that happened to me was someone put acid in a gun and shot it, and they shot it into my eyes, and that necessitated a lot of healing and a lot of problems, which for a long time I saw large circles in my eyes. Now I see smaller ones, but I do see them.
Dorothy mentioned...
So, yes, they were wounded. People were hurt. They shot into our houses. They would drop dynamite down on our heads. The police would catch it, throw it, or destroy it. The troops, rather, would catch it, throw it, and destroy it. Because these troops did come inside the building. They were fully equipped and ready to do business.
Dorothy Count Scoggins mentioned that the teachers ignored her, administrators ignored her, they didn't call on her, they sat her in the back of the classroom. How did teachers and administrators at the Central High in Arkansas...
Well, pretty much the same way, because, look, let's do a ratio here so you fully understand. This building is two blocks across, a huge, huge plant, deemed to be ranked number 10 in the United States of America in its complexity. And therefore, there were 1,900 students and 9 of us. So if, when you understand that ratio, it was a vast, vast problem to go up and down all these stairs. There were 7 stories in total. I had classes on the first 3 of those stories. And it just was an amaze of opportunities for kids to jump us in dark hallways as the hallway turned to go another direction, and so it was quite an encrust of opportunities, and they took those opportunities. We would learn later that the teachers were under guns. They were being threatened as well. Don't be nice to those people. Students were being threatened. You know, if anyone made any gesture to help us in any way, shape, or you know, they were beat up. They were treated harshly as well.
So Dorothy, I'm curious about how you were chosen to make that entrance into Harding High School. Why you? Why not every other black student in town at the time?
There were 20 families that were approached by Kelly Alexander, the late Kelly Alexander, who was the NAACP at the time, and my family was a part of that. I think part of that came from my father being a charter member of the NAACP. Conversations had been had prior to that in terms of it was 3 years after Brown. Nothing had been done. And so they approached families across the city, 20 of them. Mm. And out of the 20 families that were approached, only 5 children were selected, and only 4 kids were the ones who... went.
So 4 children.
There were 4 children.
Shouldered the burden.
Exactly.
Of integrating the school.
Right. And what they did was they put all of us in individual schools.
Deliberately to separate
you? I'm sure that was part
to isolate
you. To isolate us.
You mentioned Brown. That's the Supreme Court case, Brown v. Board of Education, which took down segregated schools. We're going to talk to David Goldfield about that when we come back in just a moment and continue to talk more about how these schools came to be integrated and how we have returned to that in a different way. But nonetheless, maybe the effect may be the same. We're coming back in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are here with Dorothy Count Scoggins, who helped to integrate Charlotte's schools, public schools, and Dr. Melba Patillo-Beals, who helped to integrate the Little Rock, Arkansas schools, one of the Little Rock 9 who attended Central High on that fateful day in 1957. And Dr. David Goldfield is also with us, professor of history at UNC Charlotte. Dorothy Count Scoggins a moment ago referenced Brown versus Board of Education. The Supreme Court declared in that ruling that segregated schools were unconstitutional, and they did that in 1954. We've been talking in the last segment about 1957, 3 years later, when these two women integrated their respective school systems. We had 3 years to prepare for this, and as Dorothy pointed out, nothing really had been done, so they pressed the issue in Charlotte. Did they press the issue in Little Rock, Dr. Goldfield? Was that why they...
Clearly, here that the Brown decision coming May 17, 1954, its center was that separate is not equal, because for more than 100 years, they had gone on a decision that separate's cool, it's equal. And so that compelled Little Rock to begin some preparation. Southern schools all had to either pretend or say they were going to begin separation. And so Central High School was not the original target. In the beginning, Central High School was the target that they used. Let's integrate this one high school in order to avoid integrating all the other schools within our atmosphere.
So we had 3 years to prepare for this, Dr. Goldfield. Set the scene for us in the country. What was the mood of the country? Obviously, the people didn't want, white people, in many cases, did not want integration, but it had been declared unconstitutional. We had 3 years to get used to the idea.
Well, let's break up the country. Most of the country was not fazed by the 1954 Brown decision because the Brown decision really only went toward de jure segregation, that is, segregation by law. It didn't touch all of the segregated schools up north that were segregated de facto. That is, well, we live in this neighborhood. There's no law against African Americans attending the school, but they just don't live in this neighborhood. So therefore, it's segregation by fact, not by law. Those jurisdictions were untouched by the Brown decision initially. The key to remember is that there was a second Brown decision in 1955, and the Supreme Court ruled in that decision that desegregation would proceed with all deliberate speed. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how you can be deliberate and speedy at the same time, but from the Supreme Court's view, they recognized the turmoil and possible violence that would occur in the South if the school districts were mandated to desegregate very quickly. So the Brown II decision in 1955 gave some leeway. And actually, Little Rock was in the forefront throughout the South in developing a plan to desegregate its schools. At the time, the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus, had a reputation of being a racial moderate. And in fact, he ran as sort of a populist, left-wing Democrat for governor. But he also recognized that segregationist sentiment was building so much in the state that he would be challenged if he wanted to run for reelection. So he changed his views on school desegregation.
And that's why he called out the National Guard to block the entry to the school.
That's correct.
But Dorothy, for instance, was pulled out after 4 days and was sent to an integrated school in Philadelphia. And we know that there are cities in the North, Boston being one, where, racism ran rampant and probably still does in some cases. Why were Philadelphia schools already integrated? Because they followed the rules quickly?
It really depends on the city, and particularly on the residential makeup of a city. Almost all American cities in the 1950s and even today focus on the neighborhood school. That's the sacrosanct school, the neighborhood school. And, of course, schools reflect their neighborhoods. I've always felt that school segregation and the resegregation, as you put it earlier, Mike, is less a factor of education than it is a factor of public policy. That is, a public policy of city planning, of how you develop your neighborhoods, the lack of affordable housing. These are issues that really impact the school much more than the simple division between segregated and desegregated schools.
Did your parents get you in retrospect, and it's been 60 years, did your parents, Dorothy, pulled you out too soon? Do you wish they had left you in, or were conditions so unmanageable that really that was the best thing?
I think one of the things is when I came home that day and shared with my father what had happened at school that day. The day before, a group of boys surrounded the table and spat in my food. That was the day before. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the pushing and shoving and those kinds of things continued to happen. And then when I came out the building and the window was shattered, mm-hmm. and I had been hit in my back and my head that day. And my father called the police chief. He also called the superintendent of schools, and he also called the principal. And what they said to him was, "We cannot guarantee her safety." Mm-hmm. And what he said to me is that if I'm sending you there for an education, if we cannot guarantee your safety, then I'm going to pull you out.
Dr. Beals mentioned in her bio information that she was aware of discrimination at the age of 3. When did you become aware of it?
Probably around the same age. And traveling during the summer, going to visit relatives, but also in the community that I lived. I mean, I lived on Johnson C. Smith's campus up until age 16. And behind us was a white neighborhood. And the kids who lived behind us on the street, our front porches faced their backyards. And they would stand there in the backyard and throw things across the fence at us. And so those kinds of things that I was aware of.
Talk to me about life. I want to hear from both of you, because we have generations now who have not experienced, who know very little about what life was like prior to integration and when Jim Crow was in full force. How would you describe your life at that point? What could you do? What could you not do? What did you have to be careful about doing?
Well, first of all, I mean, I remember the signs in black and white over the fountains. I remember not being able to go to restaurants, not being able to go to movies in downtown Charlotte, or if we did, we'd have to sit up in the balcony. What I say to people is that I was a protected child, mm-hmm. and a lot of things I was aware of, and my parents shared with all of us in terms of what we could and could not do, but at the same time, it didn't mean that it was right.
Dr. Beals, same question to you.
I just read the book called March Forward, Girl. If you know, I have a couple of books out. Warriors Don't Cry was a millions bestseller about the daily rigor of going to Central. March Forward, Girl would be the prequel to that, in which I discussed the fear that began at age 3 when I saw my parents kowtow at the grocery store to the white folks. My daily life was one of fear, expecting the Klan to rise. By age 5, I had seen a man hanged on the rafters of my church. Clearly, I couldn't go to the movies, couldn't go to anything downtown. If you were going to go anywhere, you were always given a set of rules. If somebody white is walking on the sidewalk, you step off. No matter there be mud there. Don't touch anything in the downtown stores. No dollies, no toys, no nothing. Yes, water fountains were marked colored and white. Bathrooms were separate. The ones marked colored were always in a disdained place that was dirty and unkempt and dangerous, whereas the white ones were yellow with buttercup daisies on the door. And so it was a very different life. And which immediately, by the time I was 5, I had my wagon out front trying to wait for the store to come and pick me up because I was already sick of the constriction that we experienced. I was most sick about every night my parents being frightened that the Klan might arrive, pulling all the shades and the preparation for the Klan to arrive. So the depth and breadth of the violence of my experience at Central High School is measured by the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor. I mean, if you need troops, you have a problem.
Yeah.
Why do we need the 101st? Because the difference is, at our attempt of integration, there were organized groups of adults who were armed, who came to school every single day.
Of course, the purpose of the Supreme Court's rule that the segregated schools were unconstitutional was not to end Jim Crow. It was simply to integrate the schools. But was the hope, Dr. Goldfield, was the hope that through integration this would all change? Was that the hope?
Thurgood Marshall, who the attorney for the NAACP who argued the case on behalf of the NAACP in the Supreme Court in 1954, hoped that this would be the beginning of a stretch of Supreme Court decisions that would strike down segregation in all aspects.
Did that prove to be true?
Of Southern life. After a while, it proved true, but the wheels of justice grind very slowly, particularly here in the South, and particularly when it relates to white-black relations. I think one of the important things that we're hearing from Dorothy and Melba is that the context of the 1950s was very much different from what it is today, and you brought up the issue of resegregation. Segregated schools were part of a much larger context of daily humiliation, daily robbing people of their dignity, because for African Americans, they could see what the signs white and colored meant. They could see and feel what it was like to sit in the back of the bus and to go to neighborhoods where they lived with inadequate services. They could see the discrimination in employment. They could see the white children with their brand new textbooks and their brand new science labs and their brand new schools, and they didn't have that. So the entire context was very different in the 1950s. Not that we live in nirvana today in terms of race relations, but it's less an aspect of dignity and equality than it was back in the 1950s.
Dorothy mentioned the White Citizens Council, and in her account, I think it might be in Dr. Moore's, in Dr. Beale's book, she mentions the White Citizens Council. I had never heard of the White Citizens Council, so enlighten me, Doctor. Were they individual chapters of a national organization, or were they simply happenstance named the same thing in both these cities?
No, they were part of a national organization, mostly a regional organization, actually, although some chapters did exist in states like Indiana and Illinois. But the White Citizens Council we called the Uptown Klan. It was the Uptown Klan because they wore suits and ties, but they talked the same rhetoric. And rather than engaging in violence, they threatened violence because they said, well, you know what's going to happen if these big black boys go to school with our pure white daughters, there's going to be violence. Mm-hmm. So we can't integrate our schools.
And unlike, I'm going to put words in your mouth and you can tell me I'm wrong, unlike the Ku Klux Klan, they were not involved in overt, they weren't involved in lynching, were they, or things like that? But they were certainly involved in, pardon me?
Sometimes the White Citizens Council were pretty insuited by day, and they took on their sheets and their swords at night. So don't confuse those things. The White Citizens Council in Little Rock, Arkansas, engaged in systemic training. It was also the White Mothers League that engaged in systemic training of students as to how to battle us. And the White Citizens Council then became a glue. They spread out to the neighborhood. There were originally 116 African Americans prepared to integrate. White Citizens Council members, under the cloak of committees, spread out in our neighborhood to warn students not to go, African Americans not to go. And that's how we got from 116 down to 9. Hmm. And so these are very active people with very specific goals and very specific organization, highly organized in terms of defeating any attempts at integration.
So, Dorothy, you spent 4 days at Harding. You then went to an integrated high school in Philadelphia, came back to go to college at Johnson C. Smith University here in Charlotte. And you say that by 1960 or 65, that people here were beginning to come together to have a conversation about change. Was that the conversation that we allegedly had with business people and African Americans, that we didn't want to be the next Selma? We wanted to be a different kind of city. We didn't want that reputation. Is that what was going on here?
Exactly. And I think what it was is that especially the businessmen in Charlotte were sort of embarrassed in terms of what happened back in 1957, and conversations began, and which was great because people started coming together and having those conversations, and that's when we started to see some change.
So ultimately, Charlotte, because of the way it integrated its schools and had busing, and I guess we were told to do this by the courts, that we were told to bus students for the purpose of integrating the schools, which didn't go over well, but the end result was the fact that we became this poster child, the shining example of how integration could be achieved. Did we deserve that reputation?
Well, I would say that we did, because things were working out here in Charlotte. I think we deserved it after all that was going on.
So when schools finally integrated, and when Charlotte integrated, and maybe some systems around the country copied Charlotte, because evidently we did it pretty damned well, were there measurable results? Did we see that integration not only worked for African American students, it worked for the system, it worked for the cities in which integration was strong?
African Americans bore most of the burdens of integration. They're more often than not, the black schools were closed. More often than not, African American children had to take longer bus rides than white children had to. More often than not, their teachers were not part of the integrated system.
A lot of black teachers, very good black teachers, lost their jobs.
Very good, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So African-American children and their families bore most of the...
Can we say that the benefits outweighed the negatives, or can that be said? Yeah.
Well, there have been reams of studies on this, and it shows that African-American students did benefit. Whites were not necessarily hurt by it.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk some more about that aspect and how we got to resegregation in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the road from segregation to integration and back today with Dr. David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte, author of Black, White, and Southern, Dorothy Count Scoggins, who helped integrate Charlotte schools by going to Harding High for 4 days in 1957, a pioneer. And another pioneer, Dr. Melba Petillo-Beals, author and journalist, integrated to Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas, part of the Little Rock Nine, and the author of March Forward, Girl, and Warriors Don't Cry. Dr. Beals, you went on to a very successful career in journalism. You worked for ABC or NBC News. You worked for KGO as a talk show host in San Francisco, one of the great radio stations in America. You also have a doctorate in multicultural education. So in your personal and professional opinion, did that period of integration bear fruit and move us forward in ways that may now be in jeopardy as we slip back toward segregation?
Right. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the fact that what we've learned as educators, because now I travel across the country and I try to help people set their minds straight and reselect and reset. You see, what we had to learn was desegregation is not integration. Sit two sets of people in a room, black and white. That's lovely for a couple of weeks. But if you don't have structured programs to integrate their ways of thought and understanding, if you don't have projects for them to combine their energy in, if you don't have ways of making them understand their equality from the beginning, you don't have what you went after. And that's what has happened in terms of much of the integration across the South. If I go to Central High School, which I just saw last September, yes, it is mildly integrated now, but it is not totally desegregated. You know what I mean? Why are the colored folks standing by themselves in the cafeteria? It's a good issue here. In other words, we must be educated with programs that encourage people to understand each other's assets and why we come together. Mm. And that has not always been done. Yes, we are rolling backwards. Let's catch ourselves. The effort to integrate is bigger than we thought, because it requires a total revamp of how you approach a topic, how you introduce it, and how you set up a circumstance, which in some ways makes it necessary for people to get to know each other. And we didn't do that. We just said, sit them together, and it'll work out. It did not.
Hmm. Why do you suppose it didn't work? If you agree with that, Dorothy, why didn't it work out? Why do we have situations today where, yes, we work together, and yet at the lunch break, we then go back to people like ourselves?
A lot of it has to do with trust. A lot of it has to do with not knowing each other. As Dr. Beal said, we've never really sat down and had those conversations where people get to know each other. I think a lot of it is fear as well in terms of knowing each other.
Does the fear work in both directions?
I think it works in both directions.
What are you afraid of?
Well, I'm not afraid.
All right, well, what are African-Americans afraid of?
Well, I think it's because of what they know, what has happened to them. Well, if you go back in the past, mm-hmm. what has happened to them. I think the fear comes from not trusting, not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing who that person is. And I think now it's more prevalent than ever.
Yeah.
And I think it has willed over. What has happened is it has, where the children are concerned, the children are feeling the same kinds of things. And this is why some of the things are happening where school is concerned.
Let me get your point of view on this, Dr. Beals. Talk about the trust issue here.
Okay, so one of the interesting things about my life is that when I left Central High School, and I had to leave Little Rock because there was $10,000 dead, $5,000 alive on each of the heads of the nine, I went to Santa Rosa, California, where I was taken in and reared the rest of the way by a white family. So she's right. It's not knowing each other. It's seeing these white people with these white faces, wondering who they are. I used to wonder at age 5, who put them in charge? Why are they in charge? If, as grandmother said, God loves us equally, then give me half the year and give them the other half the year. I'm going to be in charge from to June, and then give them July to December. And so if you come from a space in your life where all the time these people have been in charge, you're frightened of them. And this whole opportunity for me to go and live with Dr. and Mrs. McCabe, who were incredible people with 4 children. I'm a member of that family to this day, okay? They were Quakers. They integrated me totally into the baseline of their family. They taught me to understand one thing. They corroborated what my grandmother had said. You don't have to work to be equal. As an African-American, don't wait for somebody to endow you with equality. You're equal at birth. Now claim it and use it and make the best of it. And so part of our failure to come together is an understanding of who we are. And the other part is what the gentleman doctor said, is that the whole system of different neighborhoods, different job opportunities, keeps us also always at a jagged point. In Little Rock, Arkansas now, they're talking about setting up all these different schools, these charter schools. Well, guess what? The charter schools will be in the more lush neighborhoods. So if the African-American does not live in that neighborhood, how will he get to that school? He won't have the money for the bus. Maybe his parents don't have a car, you see what I mean? So a great part of our segregation is not just in our schools. It's about where we live, where we matriculate. And we don't understand each other's habits or each other's culture. One of the real experts in this is a guy called Dr. Suresh Prabhu. And one of the things he believes is he's an Indian, and he comes in from the outside, and he looks at it very differently. One of the things he does is he gives a fair on university level where people do nothing for a whole day but eat each other's food, look at each other's dances, look at each other's cultures, you see. And so this is important. Because we're learning is what we have. We have some desegregation, but we don't have integration.
We got off to a very bad start in this country, obviously, with slavery 400 years ago or whatever it was now. And then the changes that have come about either through legislation or court decisions forcing things, and which obviously does not make people change. You have to make that in your heart and in your mind. But we can't seem to get over this. Other countries seem to have been able to get over their divisions. Historically speaking, why can't we do this, Dr. Goldfield?
I'm not as optimistic about the other countries either,
okay.
Particularly.
We do seem to be balkanizing all around the world, that's true.
Right. I think the major issue is the history of African Americans in this country. We pride ourselves on being a nation of immigrants. Of course, African Americans are immigrants too, but they came under very different circumstances.
I question whether we pride ourselves on being a nation of immigrants.
Well, that's we're all
we say that.
We say that. But African Americans came under very different circumstances.
Right.
So their history really has been a separate track. And one of the things I try to do in teaching is try to integrate African Americans into American history, and it's difficult because their history is very different. After slavery, of course, there was Jim Crow, and I think it's even more important today because what has happened, one of the great positive stories in African American history over the past 50 years has been the rapid expansion of the black middle class. And one of the things that the black middle class has done is to move out of these subpar neighborhoods, which means that many of these communities now, children growing up, they have very few or no role models, that they have families that are broken, that they have poor city services, they have rampant crime. Schools only have these children for 6 or 7 hours a day. The great problem, I think, in our society, and Melba emphasized this as well, is to have a comprehensive approach to how we deal with and develop public policy toward the least of our citizens, particularly African Americans, given their unique history in our country. And once we address that, I think we can begin to solve some of the separation.
Is the problem today more racial more socioeconomic than it is racial? Have we gotten beyond the racial component to a certain degree? But the problem is that African Americans have always been at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale, pretty much by design.
Well, it's sort of a double whammy here. It's race and it's class.
Okay. Dr. Moore, Bruce Henderson from the Charlotte Observer asked you about your reaction to the riots that we had here after the Keith Scott shooting, because a lot of people were shocked by them. That's not Charlotte. And other people said, yes, it is. You just don't know about it. So talk to me about that for a second. A lot of people were unaware of the undercurrent of unrest that has been there all along in the black community. And you say that we're no longer having the kinds of conversations that we had in the 60s that helped us get over the hump. Today, what kind of conversations should we be having?
Basically, we should having some of the same kinds of conversations. I know I'm looking at a community that I currently live in now. It's changing. It's going through gentrification. It was a community that was an all-black community. Of when I grew up, it was a middle-class community. Then it changed, and now it's changing back. And that's one of the things that I say is in these communities that are going through this transition, conversations need to be had, but not only need to be had, they need to understand the history in terms of of Charlotte.
Once again, when you're talking about gentrification, there's an imbalance there. These are more affluent, usually white, people moving into neighborhoods and revamping them. Gentrifying them.
Trying to.
So what's in it for them to listen to what you have to say? How do you get people to listen, to understand the history that they don't know about and maybe don't care about?
Well,
they just want to have that $500,000 house there.
Well, they...
That would cost $800,000 someplace else.
But that's where my community activism comes in, because I am determined that they are going to understand the history as well. And not come in and change. They can make change, but also make sure they embrace the history that's there. So in order for them to do that, they have to understand it. So it's a struggle.
The fight to integrate schools was very public. It was very unpleasant in many places. It was uncomfortable. It was embarrassing. It was unattractive. But the forces of good won, at least for a while. But you say, Dorothy, that in some ways the schools look today exactly the way they looked prior to 1957.
They do, especially in the communities in which I live in.
Is that true across the country, Dr. Beals?
It wasn't just embarrassing. People died. In Little Rock, 8 adults died following that. People died trying to integrate those schools. And so now look what you have. You have a situation in which we have to step back and take a look at how we can rethread.
So is what's happening in Charlotte, according to Dorothy Count Scoggins here, where the schools in some cases look very much like they did prior to integration, is that happening elsewhere?
Oh, I think that is happening elsewhere. I think people are beginning to take their children out and put them in private schools. The wealthier blacks are putting their kids in private schools. The wealthier whites are putting their kids in private schools, thus leaving the gain, as you said. Those who have no money are no hope.
So it comes back to it comes back to black and white, but it comes back to socioeconomic factors as well. And Dr. Goldfield, is that are we seeing now that busing has been eliminated as a must to integrate schools? We are seeing this flight from public schools into charter schools, into private schools, etc. Maybe some homeschooling in there as well. Is that strictly because people want more choice? Is it strictly because they want to get away from lower economic people or black people? Is it because there's a changing attitude toward public education in general?
It's all of those things combined. It's all of what you just said combined. The effort to integrate schools is complex, takes more work, takes more resources. They can go to a private school and those resources are immediately available. We don't have to fight about the distribution. Part of this discussion we're having goes back to what the doc said at the beginning. It is socioeconomic. It's money. It's how much money do I have to put this school together? And how much money, where are our professors coming from? And where are our programs? And so part of this is a money issue. And part of it is a failure to comply totally with the needs and necessities of all children to be properly educated.
Parents want education for their children. They want the best education for their children, and they tend to identify the best education as having children like their own children and with parents like themselves, and that is really at the crux of it.
I have 30 seconds. We've come a long way in 60 years, clearly not far enough, but given how far we needed to go, what is your attitude about that progress, and how optimistic, Dorothy Count Scoggins, are you about the future?
All I can say is I continue to work hard, and my hope is that things can change for our children. And
Dorothy Count Scoggins, civil rights activist, helped to integrate Harding High in 1957. Dr. Melba Petillo Beals did the same thing at Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas. She's the author of March Forward, Girl, and Warriors Don't Cry. Dr. David Goldfield, professor of history at UNC Charlotte, author of Black, White, and Southern, Still Fighting the Civil War, and more. Thank you all for the hour.